Welcome to this debate, the second in the Campbell Debates series. I'm Grant Reher, host of the Campbell Conversations. You know, when I was growing up, my father used to say that there were two topics that should never be introduced with guests at the dinner table: religion and politics. If you're listening to this broadcast, I hope that you have already eaten. Is religion hurting our politics? That's the question the debaters are wrestling with this evening. A recent poll done by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life found that the number of people who say there is too much religious talk by our political leaders now stands at an all-time high since the center began asking the question. But while 38% say there is too much religious talk, 30% say there is too little, and another 25% say the amount is about right. So obviously, as a nation, we are split on how we view this. We'll try to sort that out a bit tonight. Two teams will debate the question. Arguing that religion is indeed hurting our politics are Tim Burns and Susan Thistlethwaite. Burns is a Colgate University political science professor and a panelist on WCNY's The Ivory Tower Half Hour. Thistlethwaite is a theology professor at the Chicago Theological Seminary and the On Faith columnist for the Washington Post Online Edition. They'll be opposed by Ken Kluchowski and Lawrence Mead. Kluchowski is the director of the Center for Religious Liberty at the Family Research Council. Mead is a political science professor at New York University and a noted expert on welfare reform. The debate was made possible by the generosity of the panelists who donated their time to participate, and by the hard work of the staff of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute, in particular Bethany Wallowender, Kelly Coleman, and Ben Lingaman. Speakers will alternate between the teams and their opening remarks, and then each team has the chance to rebut the other. WRVO's online edition of the debate contains the full event, which includes questions and comments from the gathered audience and final thoughts from the debaters. Audience members also voted on the proposition both before and after the debate. The debate was moderated by me. Again, the question before this House, and now you: is religion hurting our politics? Here's Tim Burns speaking in the affirmative.
I'm actually going to wear glasses. It's kind of embarrassing. Good evening. Thank you for having us. I want to preface my remarks with two preliminary comments. The first is to remind you that we are here to talk more than about the political role of religion as such in the United States. We're also here to talk about the use of religion as a central instrument of a political mobilization strategy designed explicitly to divide the American electorate, redefine the Republican Party as the home of social conservatism, and win elections. The political force that has been known since the late 1970s as the religious right was born in partisan divisiveness, lives in partisan divisiveness, and remains at the center of the partisan divisiveness that plagues our politics today. Second, I want to implore you to not take seriously any efforts by any of our opponents tonight to convince you that my partner and I are secular radicals trying to ban persons of faith from the public square or to deny religious Americans the First Amendment to exercise their religion. Nothing could be further from the truth. We welcome persons of faith to the public square. We revere the right to exercise one's religion. What we do not welcome is the use of religion as the central tool of a partisan mobilization strategy that is designed explicitly to demonize political opponents and impose one very narrow understanding of religion, indeed one very narrow understanding of Christianity, on an increasingly diverse U.S. population. We intend to argue in this light that this strategy has been disastrous for American politics because it has divided our society, debased our political discourse, misrepresented the meaning of the Constitution, and not incidentally, if that's not enough for you, encourage in our public square a form of casual blasphemy that should repulse rather than attract Americans of faith. First, the use of religion as a political mobilization strategy has introduced a pervasive absolutism to an American polity in desperate need of compromise and accommodation. Words and phrases like evil, war on God, and anti-family should have no place in democratic discourse, unless, of course, one is actually faced with these dangers. But we are not. We are instead faced with different conceptions of God and God's will, different definitions of family and their needs, and apparently different notions about what constitutes true evil in our world. In this context of honest disagreement about significant values, it is especially important that we strive to listen to each other respectfully and to separate that which is truly fundamental from that which is likely to excite short-term passions for the purposes of winning the next election. One does not readily compromise with evil or come to agreement with forces at war with one's religion. And since this war is a figment of the conservative Christian imagination in any case, it makes the dangers of their rhetoric ever more acute. Second, requiring, as many people seem to do, that their preferred political candidates take what is in effect a religious test for public office is not only a violation of the spirit of the Constitution, it is also a recipe for hypocrisy and lying. This phenomenon is on its most stark display in the spectacle of Mitt Romney contorting himself in order to convince the GOP's religious base that Mormonism is a comfortable cousin of evangelical Protestantism, and in order to repudiate every last word he has ever uttered about any social issue before he decided to run for the presidential nomination of today's Republican Party. But this dynamic is not new. Conservative candidates since Ronald Reagan have found themselves compelled to take radical positions on complex moral questions, from evolution and contraception to gay rights and the role of women in the workforce, that one can be forgiven for doubting that they actually fully believe in. The base of one of our major political parties is now made up of a powerfully mobilized community of conservative Christians who, while holding positions starkly out of step with American public opinion, nevertheless succeed year after dispiriting year in inducing ambitious politicians to feign agreement with them. I'm tempted to say that it is sinful to encourage all this lying, but I'm here to discourage overheated religious rhetoric, not to imitate it. Third, and perhaps most importantly, the effort by the Republican Party since the late 1970s to define the central cleavages of American politics and religious terms has led many religious and political leaders to take positions that are starkly inconsistent with the United States Constitution. I want to be clear about this. Preventing the imposition of one religious viewpoint on U.S. society is not a denial of religious freedom. It is instead the very heart of that freedom itself. As we all know, there will be prayer in public schools as long as there are math tests. But imposing state-mandated religious practice on impressionable school children whose parents profess a great diversity of belief or no belief is a central denial of religious liberty for millions of American families. And arguing, as many religious and political leaders have for decades, that anyone who defines religious liberty, as I have just done, is somehow anti-religious or trying to expel God from American life not only defames the goodwill of their fellow citizens, it displays, in my view, an astoundingly inappropriate reading of the American Constitution. To see how dangerous this ludicrous reading of religious liberty is, one need not look further than the notorious Pastor Terry's recent declamation at a Rick Santorum for President rally, that those who do not accept the notion that the U.S. is a Christian nation should, you ready? Get out. One of our opponent's boss, Tony Perkins, stood next to presidential candidate Rick Santorum and enthusiastically applauded Pastor Terry's bileless outrage when he should have loudly denounced it in the name of the religious freedom that he claims to support. Regardless of how one reads the religious views of the founders, and believe me, they were way more complicated than you'll see on television, misguided attempts to disrespect and marginalize Jews, Muslims, or even Christians whose view of Jesus' message do not conform to, say, Rick Santorum's, are destined to introduce ever more discord and resentment in an American population that grows inevitably more diverse every day. This diversity is inescapable, and the authentically American response to that diversity is to seek common ground within it. It is not to bury our heads in the sand and pine for some monolithic America that never existed anyway, and it is certainly not to endorse out of our own confusion and fear starkly inappropriate and unconstitutional practices. Finally, and my partner will have more to say about this than I, but I can't help it, as some set of the American population pretends, or at least they apparently do, that God takes an active interest in the ever-shifting sands of American politics, and that God has a firm set of preferences concerning who should occupy the White House, it seems to me that this borders on blasphemy. And I'm not a theologian, so I may not have the words exactly right. The literal laying on of hands of candidates at political meetings, the explicit claim of godly favor, the repetitive assertion that God's role in the great complexity of the human story is represented by one set of candidates and one set of positions on one set of issues in 2012 strikes me as outrageous and should repulse people of honest faith. In the current context, the conservative mobilization strategy around conservative Christianity would have us believe that God prefers tax cuts for the wealthy to health insurance for children, immediate war with Iran to diplomacy and renewed efforts for peace, and yes, higher rates of teen pregnancy and sexually transmitted disease over responsible use of condoms. Mind you, being humble, I would never claim that God agrees with me or any political party I might belong to about these complicated matters on which persons of varied faith and no faith honestly disagree. But the claim that God agrees with, for example, Rick Santorum's cramped understanding of human freedom, or that one set of policy proposals should be passed into American law because they conform to one limited account of God's will, is frankly foolish, un-American, and a deeply worrying threat to the health of our precious democracy. Therefore, I urge you to support the proposition before us that religion has harmed our politics. Thank you.
You're listening to the Campbell Debates on WRVO. You just heard from Tim Burns speaking in favor of the proposition. Now we'll hear from Ken Kluklowski speaking against it.
Good evening, and thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here. Appreciate you coming out for something that captures so much interest for so many people. I would start with a quote by Blaise Pascal where he said, "Men never do evil so completely and cheerfully as when they do it from religious conviction." I think that is sometimes true. So I think the question on whether religion harms politics, well, that would depend in part, I think, in terms of what those religious beliefs are. I think there are religious beliefs that are beneficial. I think there are other religious beliefs that can be harmful. Someone who believes that they're carrying out a divine will to strap a bomb to a child and to send that child into a setting where they're going to be blown up and take other innocent people with them, that is a theological belief system that I think is harmful to any aspect of society that it touches, including the political realm, as individuals with those beliefs would inject themselves into public policy. On the flip side, if we're looking at teachings and belief regarding love, regarding charity, regarding mercy, in that sense, I think that to the extent to which that can inform not just our public policy, but also our political process, how we treat one another, how we speak to one another, both privately in terms of voter to voter or citizen to citizen, and also in the halls of Congress and state legislatures in terms of dealing with people in good faith, I think that benefits politics, not just in the political process itself, but also in terms of societal benefits. For example, if you have an individual who believes that there is a God, God is always watching them, and that they believe it is divine commands that they should not lie, that they should not steal, that they should be trustworthy, that they should be faithful, I think that person is likely to be a good employee, the kind of person you would like to have as a coworker, or if you're a business owner, the kind of person you'd like to have working under you. He's likely to get up and get to work on time. He's likely to work a full day, not leave too early, not take breaks that are too long. We all make mistakes at work. It seems like a person like that is more likely to be honest about their mistakes, offer to fix them instead of trying to cover them up. And so I think in the extent that you have that, you have societal benefits going on. I think one of the things that surprises me so much is how quickly the needle has moved in terms of what we regard as either the degree of religious content in political speech or public speech, and also how desirable it is or not. A lot of people are surprised that one of our presidents said this: "The truth is, politics and morality are inseparable. And as morality's foundation is religion, religion and politics are necessarily related. We need religion as a guide. We need it because we are imperfect, and our government needs the church because only those humble enough to admit their sinners can bring to democracy the tolerance it requires in order to survive. The state is nothing more than a reflection of its citizens. The more decent the citizens, the more decent the state. If you practice a religion, whether you're Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, or guided by some other faith, then your private life will be influenced by a sense of moral obligation, and so too will your public life. Without God, there is no virtue, because there's no prompting of the conscience. Without God, we're mired in the material, that flat world that tells us only what the senses perceive. Without God, there is a coarsening of society. And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure. If we ever forget that we're one nation under God, then we will be a nation gone under. A lot of people are surprised that those words were spoken by President Ronald Reagan. It wasn't some statement from a founding father in days of yore. It was less than three decades ago. And he said it in 1984. He said it in proximity to a presidential election. That kind of speech, if it were to be made today by either party, I think would be headline news. I think it would be top of the news. I think there would be accusations of theocracy, or to a lesser extent, perhaps theonomy, the idea of trying to cram religion down people's throats. That was not a particularly controversial speech when President Reagan gave it in 1984. But that did not begin and end with Reagan. The first president of the United States had said, of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism, who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness, these firmest props of the duties of men and citizens. Now, Washington said that in his farewell address as he was trying to communicate a lasting message for the American people. You know, and we see that some of our heads of state have been more religious than others, just like in this audience and across the country. Some of you are going to be of one faith, some of another, some perhaps of no faith at all. Of those of you who are people of faith and even of the same faith, some of you are going to be more fervent than others. Even among the secular ones of our early leaders, though, take, for example, Thomas Jefferson, who did not believe in the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ, did not believe in the virgin birth, in fact, believe in the moral teachings of Jesus Christ. But the Jefferson Bible is one that he took the Gospels and X'd out all the lines that had any reference to the miraculous, and then took the moral teachings and said, this is a wonderful moral code for us all to live by. Now, of course, Jefferson was the one who wrote the letter to the Danbury Baptist, which is often quoted and often misquoted, for the proposition of the wall of separation between church and state. Now, Jefferson wrote that in response to a letter they had sent him. He wrote it on a Saturday. The following day, on Sunday, he went to church. He went to the largest church held in the nation's capital, which was in the chamber of the U.S. House of Representatives. And that's where he went every Sunday, where the facility itself was transformed into a church service in a church building. At one point, he thought that the music being played with the hymns was substandard, so as commander-in-chief, he ordered the United States Marine Corps to send their band to play the music for the hymns that would be sung during church services on a Sunday morning. That was not considered an affront to the Constitution. And this, remember, is one of the most secular of the founding fathers who did that. So I think as we look at that, the reality is it comes to the clash that I think you have in part on the role of religion comes to two different views of humanity. You have the classical view of humanity that man is a morally imperfect being, a flawed being, to use the old-fashioned biblical term, that we're all sinners. And as such, that government is a force to protect the weak from the strong, to help the weak who are being victimized by the strong, and to ensure justice because people left without government would perpetrate acts of injustice. On the flip side, you have a romantic conception of humanity, that man is basically good, that he may be burdened down by societal flaws, that there might be structural flaws that we need to work out in terms of our social fabric, but that man has infinite good potential in him, that man could achieve moral perfection. And I think your view on the role of government in that case becomes that government is just the instrumentality that people who are not so beset by greed or materialism that they're willing to serve their fellow man in government, that these are the saints who are going to make everything work, which is why no one ever has a problem with the Bureau of Motor Vehicles or TSA or other governmental entities, and it's why incidents like Hurricane Katrina always go off without a hitch. Government works perfectly well, full of these saintly people. Now, the reality is that this is also borne out because you hear a lot of rhetoric on the Constitution. And people point to the Establishment Clause, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion, prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The reality is that the modern conception of the Establishment Clause is so far divorced from its historical meaning that in reality, and as recently as 1952, the Supreme Court wrote in Zurich v. Clausen, we are a religious people whose institutions presuppose a supreme being. We guarantee the freedom to worship as one chooses. We make room for a wide variety of beliefs and creeds. We sponsor an attitude on the part of government that shows no partiality to any one group and that lets each flourish according to the zeal of its adherents. When the state encourages religious instruction or cooperates with religious authorities by adjusting the schedule of public events to sectarian needs, it follows the best of our traditions. Now, that was written just a half century ago. The reality is, while we may talk about separating governmental power from certain religious creeds so as not to coerce anyone to violate their own religious conscience, the idea of separating religious faith from public life has never been on the table, nor should it be. Thank you.
That was Ken Lukowski from the Family Research Center. Now joining the debate and speaking in favor of the proposition is Susan Thistlethwaite from the Chicago Theological Seminary.
I'm glad to hear women can't sin. Our opponents, I am surprised, did not invoke yet American exceptionalism, which in common parlance sometimes mean God loves us best. But I actually believe that what makes America exceptional is that we chose to place limits on the power of religion in regard to the state, protecting freedom, including religious freedom. There are examples of when religious freedom from religion was not protected in American history, and it had severe consequences for politics. The first example that I will offer is the Confederate Constitution. The Confederate Constitution starts with an appeal to God. The American Constitution does not mention the word God, but the Confederate does. 1861. We, the people of the Confederate States, each state acting in its sovereign and independent character, in order to form a permanent federal government, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invoke the favor and guidance of Almighty God. God's favor is established, and the other big difference between the Confederate Constitution and the American Constitution is that slavery is sacrosanct. To actually pass a law in the Confederacy would have been unconstitutional if it manumitted slaves. No bill of attainder, ex post facto law defying or impairing the right of property in Negro slaves shall be passed. And pro-slavery preachers and those who supported the Confederate States, according to their religious writings, felt they were acting on conscience. Moving from 1861 to current times, Judeo-Christian theological concepts have been used to justify denying lesbian, gay men, bisexual, transgender American taxpaying citizens the right to marry. The Alabama state constitution actually has a sanctity of marriage amendment. Alabama Constitutional Article 136.3 specifically not only uses the word sanctity, that word that means holy or sacred, is specific religious language and defines marriage as a sacred covenant. And the first meaning of sacred is connected to God. Thus, in two historic struggles for equal human rights in the United States, God language is specifically deployed in law as a justification for what otherwise cannot be justified in terms of equality under the law. My second reason for harm, we are debating harm, not just is it a good idea, is there harm? I'm trying to make a case for harm. Appeals to conscience and struggles over reproductive rights reveal how an attempt to establish the theological perspectives of one religious view or group is being imported under the guise of religious freedom, and this is resulting in chaos and political gridlock. In recent years, conscience clauses have been deployed unequally, privileging a particular religious viewpoint not only in abortion, but contraception, artificial insemination, and potentially now not even non-reproductive health care services, as in the Blunt Amendment, which was a huge overreach. In these efforts to expand religious freedom and conscience in public policy, some religious freedom is suffering. My own religious freedom suffers because the use of contraception to me and to my church, the United Church of Christ, of which I am an ordained minister, says that reproductive responsibility is an ethical responsibility. So my religious freedom is constrained by this other view of religious freedom and conscience. There needs to be a delicate balance so that we have both freedom of religion and freedom from one religious viewpoint having tyranny over another. Proof of this is the kind of legislative gridlock we face as a nation. Faith-based politics mistakes politics for faith, and thus can be no compromise. To compromise your faith is sin, and governance grinds to a halt. Thirdly, the violation of constitutional guarantees of freedom of religion when religion is used to dictate to politics. I have argued first, establishing one religious viewpoint in politics has been used to recruit God into supporting slavery. It's being used to support recruiting God into defending homophobia. And thirdly, the denial for some women to follow the dictates of their consciences in exercising their own reproductive responsibility. Overreach is the kind of violation of religious freedom that I saw in an example called the Justice Sunday events. Justice Sunday was a term used for a series of religious conferences organized by the Family Research Council and the Focus on the Family organization. And there were a total of three, and they were called, and the first Justice Sunday was called Stopping the Filibuster Against People of Faith. This was organized primarily to protest a perceived bias on the part of the federal judiciary of the United States, and the goal was to have a large number of evangelical Christians place pressure on U.S. senators to bring an end to the filibuster of nominees to the federal judiciary that had been made by President Bush. The Justice Sunday was televised, took place at Highview Baptist Church in Louisville, Kentucky. The program featured James Dobson, Albert Mohler, Charles Cosen, and via videotape, U.S. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. I was asked to watch this by several news outlets in streaming video. I watched the whole thing, and then I was participated in a news conference. I watched as people sat in the pews and from the chancel area of the church, the place that surrounds the altar, they were given an instruction on how to program their cell phones with the number to call in the Senate. And I asked myself as a pastor, how would the person in the pew feel who didn't agree, who didn't want to program his or her cell phone, didn't want to participate? You're in a church from the chancel. What pressure is there put on you for your religious liberty and your conscience? I thought without a doubt this violated the religious freedom of those congregants. I thought that it was sacrilegious. And I said, as a pastor, I thought it was sacrilegious. You ask yourself, you come to this debate, what is the harm? What is the harm? Historically, God into the Constitution has been done in this country to justify slavery. It is currently being done to justify denying LGBT Americans, citizens, the simple right to marry, and to reduce the religious freedom of some, namely myself, to privilege the religious freedom of conscience of others in relationship to contraception. The harm, I submit to you, is this kind of religious overreach is tyranny. Thank you.
That was Susan Thistlethwaite arguing that religion is hurting our politics. The final speaker in this section of opening remarks is Lawrence Mead from New York University. He will argue against the proposition.
Thanks again for inviting us. This is an important issue, and I'm glad to weigh in on it. I feel I've been here before. I've been involved for years in debate about contentious questions about poverty and welfare. I've seen every possible position on these questions justified from a religious point of view, as well as a secular point of view. Typically, my role has been to advocate forms of welfare reform involving requiring people to work. As it happens, most organized church groups oppose that. Some of them have told me they're concerned about my soul. You know, if I go on talking like this, I might not get into heaven. And I say to them, they're a little too concerned with getting into heaven. They should focus more on actually helping the poor. And for that, to that end, work is effective. So I've already been on this turf and been bloodied a few times. I become tolerant of religious argument. And I want to advocate that we should all be more tolerant. Now, the issue here isn't primarily about the establishment of religion. It isn't about the First Amendment. Tim has suggested that a religious mobilization is part of a vast conservative movement designed to enact and impose all kinds of unpleasant policies. And I don't necessarily have a view on those policies, but I think we're exaggerating enormously if we think that religion is the main issue on those questions. So it's not about school prayer, it's not about establishing religion. It's really about two more limited questions, and that is it a good idea to have religious motivation enter into politics? And that, I think, there's two dimensions to that. One of them is policy, and that is, will it change what government does? And the other more important matter is really about the manner of politics, how we debate matters. Now, turning to policy first, it's true that some people take positions on issues out of religious motivation. Some of those questions they've already been mentioned, abortion, birth control, capital punishment, these are issues where, for example, the Catholic Church takes a strong position opposing abortion, capital punishment, and most forms of birth control. However, many other Americans reject these positions, including many Catholics. Now, I don't have a problem with religious motivation, provided that people also give non-religious arguments. It seems to me they owe an argument to the public interest. They ought to show why what they want to do is in society's interest. That is not predominantly or even mainly a religious issue. It has to do with serving the society. And on many questions, it isn't clear which side religion should favor. And although one may take a view on the religious issues, one is, I think, obligated, and most people actually do offer secular reasons as well. And those are those that we should pay attention to. Many of those who oppose religious involvement in these issues do so because they oppose the policies themselves. I mean, that's the motivation I'm hearing from Tim and Susan. They're saying we don't want religion to be connected to a lot of things that we disapprove of, like opposing abortion, for example, or opposing gay marriage, and so on. It seems to me that one shouldn't really talk about motivation here. One should talk about the issues. One should take a position on the policies themselves. That's the place to take a stand. And on those matters, there are arguments usually for or against that are purely secular. And those are the ones that we ought to focus on. And most of those who are driven into these questions by religion also do offer those arguments, and those are the ones we ought to pay attention to. Mitt Romney has not run as a Mormon. He's not selling anything about Mormonism on the campaign. He's selling a certain program for winning the presidency, and that program is quite secular. It doesn't have anything to do with his personal religious beliefs. What I'm hearing in part from the critics is that they're uneasy with religious passion in politics. It's somehow strange and frightening, and they're terrified of this, and that's what we're getting. Well, it seems to me it's time to wake up, smell the coffee, and realize that this is part of politics, and it doesn't have to be a negative part, provided that one focuses on the substance of the issues. I think there's a tendency for particularly academics to think it improper that they should face passion from people outside the university world, the world of expertise, those who don't know as much about the issues as they do. This is disconcerting. In the world that I first grew up in the 60s and 70s, the academic world had pretty much a monopoly on passion. They knew what was right for the country. There wasn't much debate about it, and they pushed ahead. And then in the 80s and 90s, we begin to see a serious conservative movement coming up primarily outside the universities. It's extremely hard for people inside academia to accept that there can be passion to the right as well as to the left. I actually think that religious motivations actually should promote a concern for the public interest, and we shouldn't be afraid of that. In the biblical tradition, those who hold public office are supposed to be servants of the society, and the Bible takes that very seriously, both in the Old and the New Testament. Public leaders have their own authority. They are not beholden to religious groups. They don't speak for the Pope or anybody in particular. Rather, they hold a moral trust for the society, and they are held accountable in those terms. In secular terms, about serving the society. Without religious motivation, I think our politics would be worse off than they are, because we wouldn't have a substrate of expectation about moral behavior in public office. Now, let me turn to the second matter, and that is the manner of politics. And I've already touched on this to some extent. Some think that to let religion into the public square leads to rigidity, to intolerance, to all the things which our opponents have alluded to. Now, I agree that that style does animate some of those who take religious positions on social and moral issues. But I think Tim and Susan have vastly exaggerated the role of religion in producing that rigidity. I think most of it's implicit in the nature of the issues themselves. Some of the questions we're talking about, right to life questions, are inherently divisive. There's no way, no easy way to compromise these matters. They have to be fought out, and we come out with messy compromises that no one's satisfied with. It's in the nature of the issue. I don't think that we can reach an easy accommodation on these matters. And that has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with the matter of the issues themselves. They would be contentious even without religion. It's not like balancing the budget, where it's more or less. They tend to be matters that political scientists call valence questions, where they're either right or wrong, and it's really hard to reach a middle. I think we can still do it, but we shouldn't expect that it's going to be easy. Also, I don't think we should take guidance from the past. I think part of what we're hearing from the critics is the idea that religion has motivated things that we now think deeply immoral in the past, such as slavery, the subordination of women, denial of gay rights, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe that happened. I'm not saying that we should justify that, and I don't think that religion is responsible today for all of the errors of the past. The question is, how do people argue today, and is the manner of their argument consistent with a civil politics? I generally think that that's true, or when there is incivility, and there certainly is today, it's coming from other sources. It's the nature of the issues, and also the partisan polarization between the two parties. The great fact about American politics that has changed in the last 20 years has been that the parties have moved to the extremes. They overlap a lot less than they did in terms of positions, and that is really the reason why we have what seems like great conflict. So I don't think we should blame all of that on religion. We're in an uncomfortable place politically, and actually I think religion may help us in reaching an accommodation, partly because, as our critics have already alluded to and Ken has alluded, religion also commands civility. One thing we're supposed to do if we are believers in any of the traditional faiths, is that we should behave towards others with civility and respect. We should reach accommodation with our critics. Jesus says we should be reconciled with our brother with whom we differ. Rather than coming into conflict, we should seek harmony. And that involves listening respectfully to what other people say. And anyone who claims a religious mandate in politics, no, they shouldn't do it explicitly, but even if there's actual motivation, they have to listen to the commandment to be humble and listen to the other. See, working out differences is a crucial aspect of what we should be about. And in that doing, in working that out, even dealing with people with whom we deeply disagree, we do move the society forward towards wisdom. Jesus said we need to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, unto God the things that are God. And I think one thing we owe to Caesar is a concern for the public interest. Those who are involved in politics should care about the society first, and their motivation may well be religious, but they must make civil arguments. And the manner also matters. We must listen to each other respectfully, and in that way, come to an accommodation. And I think that's what we're doing here tonight, as a matter of fact. We're talking about the role of religion in an essentially non-religious way, as we should. This is about the civility of American politics. Thank you.
You're listening to the Campbell Debates on WRVO. You've just heard Larry Mead give the final set of opening remarks on the debate proposition. This assembly believes religion is hurting our politics. Mead was speaking against that proposition. I'm Grant Reher, moderator of the debate and the host of the Campbell Conversations on WRVO. When we come back, the rebuttals from each debate team. You're listening to a broadcast of the Campbell Debates on WRVO. This debate on the question of whether religion is hurting our politics was originally held on April 26 at the Everson Museum's Hosmer Auditorium. Before the break, you heard the opening remarks from each of the four debaters. Now, you'll hear each team attempt to rebut the other. First up are speakers in the affirmative, Tim Burns from Colgate University and Susan Thistlethwaite from the Chicago Theological Seminary. They'll be followed by Ken Klukowski and Lawrence Mead speaking in the negative. Now, Tim Burns and Susan Thistlethwaite.
So the first half of Lawrence Mead's presentation I agreed with completely. The idea that we should be tolerant of each other. This is a little bit what I said at the very beginning. This is kind of a great mistake, I think, in American politics. That is, those who resist the introduction of religion, not in the sense of being nice to people, but the imposition of religious views upon the public realm, that we are somehow intolerant of them. No, it's the intolerance of the religious against people who don't want them to impose it upon them. And I thought Lawrence Mead did an excellent job of expressing that mistake. I mean, it's just beautifully phrased, but it's just wrong. That's not the country that I live in. Similarly, I thought the idea that we should have what philosophers call public reasons, I completely agree with that. As I also said at the beginning, have no opposition to someone coming into the public realm holding positions because they hold a religious view on that position. Of course they do. Most Americans believe in God. Most Americans have deep religious convictions. It would be foolish to think that we would leave them at the door somehow as we enter into politics. The point is that you must have reasons that can be persuasive to people who don't share your theological beliefs. And on some issues, I agree that the debate is being held on those grounds, and on others, I do not. And you know, we don't have time to go into which issue is which issue is which issue, but we agree that it's okay, of course it's okay, to have religious conviction when you come into politics. That's why I said, the first thing I said was that we don't oppose religion in the public square. We oppose the imposition of law on other religions without there being secular or public reasons for that policy being imposed. I'll leave time for Susan to say some things as well. In terms of Ken's presentation, I agreed with that too a lot. The idea that love, charity, and mercy are good things, I endorse that. If I was running a business, I would want people to take short breaks from work. I'm for that too. But the idea that that's what the role of Christian conservatism in the United States has been for the last 25 years is, with all due respect, simply a fantasy. I mean, if that's what we thought Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson were doing, if that's what we thought the Rick Santorum campaign was about, then I would say, fine, I like nice people. I'm in favor of honest employees. I submit that that is not what it's about. I was not even the slightest bit surprised, by the way, that that speech was given by Ronald Reagan. I recognized it immediately as the kind of views that Ronald Reagan held. And I would submit to you that this is the exact moment in history I was talking about when the Republican Party pulled this really clever jujitsu. And they made the claim that if you don't agree with them on everything, you hate God, you're anti-family, you're immoral. Ronald Reagan ran in two presidential elections, once against a Sunday school teacher from Plains, Georgia, and the other from the child of a minister in Minnesota. Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale were not some wild-eyed secular people who were trying to destroy religion. They simply existed in another political party that was not adopting the particularly religious-based positions that Ronald Reagan was. And so Ronald Reagan wasn't just making nice speeches about wouldn't it be good if we all sort of thought the world was a better place. He was the head of a political party that was actively demonizing people who did not agree with him, as this has always been my favorite, opposition to family. I find that unacceptable, that the pro-family movement was adopted by that man whose speech that Ken wrote. There are words, one more second, I just want to say one other thing. There are certain positions in our public realm these days that are fundamentally religious. The personhood amendments, the view of evolution being taught in public schools, the idea that marriage, as Susan so eloquently said, is a sacrament, is sacralized. It's not our side that brought religion into that in that case. And the very foolish words that are sometimes thrown around in terms of crusades and all this. People bring religious views to exactly the kind of, you know, Lawrence Mead sounds so reasonable. He is reasonable, right? what could be wrong with that? But if you look at the politics of the country we actually live in, and the candidates who endorse the kind of religious views that Ken is in favor of, that's not the kind of politics I see. The reasonableness of this debate being in favor of love, charity, and mercy, I'm for that, but that's not what I see in American politics. Thank you.
Hurry up here so I can share my time equally. I too wish that you were, frankly, in charge, Larry, of the role of religion in the public square, because I often find, actually, that it is not religion in the public square, but we have moved toward a kind of theological hegemony. And Ken, I wrote down what you said. God is always watching. My model of God is not that God is a CEO wanting to make sure you don't take too many breaks. That's not my model of God. And I think that is inappropriate to bring that kind of theological perspective into the public square and say, by implication, if you don't hold that doctrine of God, you're not going to work. Secondly, if you are not a person of faith, you are going to be a slacker. I think that there is a shift now. I think theocracy has always worked out badly. I said slavery as an example of when it did work out badly. I think it is not yet settled, and we are not yet settled on equal rights for LGBT Americans. And the major driving force in preventing equal rights for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender Americans is religion. So I think our team perspective is that the harm comes from the hegemonic, tyrannical, one theological perspective. And I did not think that Rick Santorum was actually running for president. He seemed to be running for theologian in chief. Thank you.
That was Tim Burns and Susan Thistlethwaite arguing in favor of the proposition that religion is hurting our politics. Now, rebutting their arguments are Ken Klukowski from the Family Research Center and Lawrence Mead from New York University, who will have the last word.
All right, several points to make in rebuttal. First of all, for example, the example of abortion came up. The so-called contraceptive mandate deals with a lot of Catholic teaching against contraception. For the record, I'm an evangelical Protestant, not a Catholic, so I'm going to defend these positions, but not as one who necessarily has exactly those same doctrinal views. The issue here becomes there is a regulation passed pursuant to Obamacare that if the Supreme Court does not entirely strike down Obamacare, and we'll find that out one way or the other at the end of June, that Catholic hospitals would have to start providing contraception and other services of that nature, debatably including abortifacients, at low or no cost. And the issue there is whether that violates the religious beliefs of those people. Can a person be required to engage in an activity that violates their own religious conscience? Now, as that goes into effect, there are lawsuits underway. We'll see how that plays out as a matter of religious conscience. But the issue is, I dealt with one person involved with one of these Catholic charitable hospitals recently who said if it's not repealed, they will shut down rather than do it. And it pains them to do it, but they would rather go find another line of work than to do something that to them makes them believe that they are violating God's will for their lives. I certainly supported the Blunt Amendment as a way to get around that. An example was raised of slavery being used to justify, religion being used to justify slavery. On the flip side, the abolitionist movement was by and large a religious movement. Some of the most religious of our presidents, such as John Adams, was an inveterate foe of slavery. And originally, the movement that created the Republican Party in the 1850s started as a Christian abolition movement. So I think that's an issue that plays on both sides. You had some saying, some invoking it the wrong way, and you had others invoking it to say, oh, it's God's will that men should be free. So it gets back to what I said, that it's not religion per se that's being indicted. It's exactly what it is you believe. That there are some beliefs that are harmful, there are some beliefs that are helpful. Now, in terms of the idea of forcing religious belief upon other people, the gay rights agenda came up in the previous discussion as well. There was a New Mexico photographer who was a devout Christian, had a same-sex couple come to her asking her to photograph their commitment ceremony, their form of a wedding. And she said that with her religious beliefs, she didn't feel comfortable for that. She was sued under an anti-discrimination law in New Mexico, and her business is no more. There's a Vermont couple that owns a family bed and breakfast that was asked by a same-sex couple to host their same-sex marriage reception there. They again expressed an objection on religious grounds. They're now in court being threatened with their business being shut down. There are three lawsuits underway right now that I know of people in counseling programs, finishing their counseling degrees, two of which have been expelled from their counseling programs because during their practical part where they were actually doing live counseling, both of these had a same-sex couple asking them for counseling, where the counseling code requires that the counselor must first affirm the values that are being espoused there. Now, the counseling code of ethics gives as an example, if you have a religious objection to doctor-assisted suicide, then if someone comes to you seeking affirmation for that, you can ethically refer them to someone else. These students thought they were following that same example in doing it. Yet they've been kicked out of the program, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit just recently ordered one of them reinstated. So it's not that Christian conservatives are being theocrats and tyrannizing people. There's some damage being done in terms of people of conservative religious faiths who are being demanded not to tolerate something else, but being demanded to embrace it and conform to it themselves at the threat of losing their livelihood if they won't. And I think part of what this, you know, public figures should vote based on their moral beliefs. If someone believes that the death penalty is immoral, even though I support the death penalty, I certainly respect that if they're a legislator and they're being asked to vote on whether to repeal the death penalty in their state, they would vote to repeal it. And it's nonsensical, it's farcical, to pretend that their religious belief did not influence that decision. We all have values. The only question is, what are our values and where do we derive it from? In terms of abortion, I believe that abortion ends a human life. That's why I oppose it. Now, certainly that agrees with my religious belief. I also have a secular understanding of it. It's my understanding of biology. But nonetheless, it's a fiction to think that any person of any belief can completely separate that from what they vote to be good policy versus bad policy. This all comes back to the issue that religious freedom is about not being coerced, being free to practice your own belief according to your own conscience.
So we've got 2 minutes left, is that right? Okay. I agree with Ken that actually religion has been in the forefront of expanding rights from a viewpoint that liberals would support. I will go into that more in the questions if you like. I've had some direct experience with that myself, which I view as very positive. The main thing I want to say is that the desire to circumscribe debate, to keep certain arguments out, is, I think, a deep mistake, even from a liberal or secular point of view. It's exactly by engaging in debate that unreasonable views from a religious point of view or other suffer feedback, and they have to adjust, and they have to become wider and wiser because they have dealt with the feedback. I hear among our opponents and other liberals that there's a fear of theological argument. Somehow this is going to get out of control, it's going to take over. There's the phrase they use is theological hegemony. I don't believe that. I think in America there are many points of view, there is a wide-ranging public debate, nobody has hegemony. That's the whole point of our public debate. I would even say that to bear the burdens of that debate is essential to freedom. I have an idea that I've been developing recently called the burdens of freedom. It isn't really freedom, but the burdens of freedom that make America rich and strong. And the burdens include dealing with confused moral and religious debates, the kind we're talking about. Sorting all that out is very difficult, but the upshot is wisdom. The upshot is the society moves forward. And the very fact that religious people enter into that, they are exposing themselves to that. They are suffering the feedback, and they need to hear it. And the same for the liberals, those who oppose them. So let's not circumscribe the debate. Let's enter into it in the faith that we will come out at a better place.
Thank you for listening to this Campbell debate on religion and politics. I'm Grant Reher, host of the Campbell Conversations on WRVO and moderator of the debate. Perhaps, if your own bottom-line views on the question did not change with the debate, you've now heard some things that might cause you to think differently about various aspects of it. Or, perhaps, you see more complexity involved in it than you did before. In any case, I hope you have found the experience worthwhile. Be on the lookout for future debates in the series to be broadcast on WRVO. Again, for the Campbell Debates and WRVO, thank you for listening.